Welcome back to the program. In life, there's often a disconnect between what we mark and what we celebrate and the actual underlying reasons that we do it. We mark births and deaths, yet the backstory for both may have been years in the making. We mark the beginning and end of wars, yet give little significance to the reasons that led to either. So too was it for the founding of the American Republic. 1776 marks the year in which seminal events took place, but the events that gave birth to them happened earlier. In what esteemed historian Kevin Phillips says was 1775, a good year for revolution. That's the title of Kevin Phillips' new book. Kevin Phillips has been a political and economic commentator for over four decades. He's the author of 15 books, many of which have been New York Times bestsellers. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and one of the most astute observers of American politics. It is my pleasure to welcome Kevin Phillips back to this program to talk about 1775, a good year for revolution. Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. You say that basically July 4th, 1776, a date that we kind of mark and celebrate, was really the last in a series of events and declarations that had been taking place for over a year.
Well, if you go back carefully, you can actually say that the revolution started during the First Continental Congress in September and October 1774, when they basically, and I'm not exaggerating here, set in motion what amounted to an economic declaration of war on the British Empire, because they were saying that they weren't going to consume British goods, they weren't going to send their crops to Britain unless the British did what they wanted. And this was all set out, and the British, as soon as they saw what was being done, had no truck with it at all, started preparing for what they would do about it, and set in motion during early 1775 a number of measures short of war. But then in August of 1775, the king declared the 13 colonies in rebellion. The whole process was a very significant and lengthy and complicated one, and it's been lost, or certainly subordinated, in the way in which 1776 has become a shorthand for the beginning of the revolution, and July 4th has become the seminal launching event. Now, in point of fact, it wasn't the launching event, and it wasn't even signed on the 4th of July. It wasn't signed until August. It was collateral. It was something that had to be done to pave the way for foreign alliances before the British troops landed in New York and New Jersey, which they were starting to do in June 1776.
Coming back to the fall of 1774 and the events as they would unfold into 1775, talk a little bit about these economic ultimatums that the Continental Congress initially made and then were made repeatedly, which resulted in the exodus of British troops and the expulsion of many of the royal governors up and down the coast.
Well, what happened, and it's important to, I'll try to state it simply, but it comes in layers. What happened in the Continental Congress that convened in September of 1774 was two things. First, there was a desire to help Massachusetts, which had been subjected to the coercive acts by the British government, which basically closed the port of Boston because of the Tea Party and then abrogated, just half disposed of the previous system of Massachusetts government. So there was a desire to help Massachusetts. But part of the desire to help Massachusetts also included some serious local considerations on the part of the tobacco colonies, Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina, because they were going broke. They didn't get good prices for their tobacco, and they had to send it all to Britain. Their whole economies were regulated in having to go through British merchants. There was no reliable currency. Debt became a huge problem because there wasn't the money that you needed to conduct commerce. It's all very complicated, but it was a big problem for them. So they decided that, hey, we could basically make a deal with Massachusetts here. We would support them against the crown and say if the British try to subject Massachusetts by military force, we'll support them. But it would also be very convenient for the tobacco colonies and South Carolina with rice and indigo to start setting up a boycott of British commercial arrangements. And the first thing they did was organized to stop importing British goods. And this was in November of 1774, November and December, and there were stages of it that took place. And then if the British did not give in to the American demands, then what you would do would be cut off all the exports of tobacco, of indigo, of rice that Britain needed and wanted to make profits out of, and that would happen in September of 1775. Now, the British immediately took umbrage. They recognized this was an economic declaration of war. They started preparing to answer it. They were coming to the conclusion that it was the equivalent of treason. They prepared legislation which was passed before Lexington and Concord. People don't understand that all this was happening before Lexington and Concord. They passed legislation to block the colonists from fishing in the North Atlantic and block the colonists from trading with any part of the world that wasn't Britain or British colonies. And by the middle of 1775, according to this legislation, the Royal Navy would seize American colonial ships that were doing this. Well, as it went back and forth, ultimately by August of 1775, the king said, that's it. You're declared in rebellion. Serious stuff.
Talk a little bit about what was happening simultaneously with the British troops that were there.
Well, the British troops and governors were in a funny position. They relied on the goodwill of the colonies, and the goodwill was presumed because they were subordinate to Britain and they were part of an apparatus. But there weren't many troops in the colonies. They were in scattered forts like Ticonderoga and Crown Point in upstate New York and some others. By the autumn of 1775, all the British forts had been vacated. They'd been captured or vacated. By the end of 1775, you had 10 royal governors in the 13 colonies. And by the end of 1775, six of them had flown to warships or other ships in the harbor, and several were under the equivalent of house arrest, or several were just too ineffective to matter. British government had been pushed off the continent, or at least off the part of it occupied by the 13 colonies. And as part of what the First Continental Congress did to enforce the commercial boycotts, towns and counties were requested to set up committees. Now, originally they were more commercial, but by April, May of 1775, they became what amounted to county boards of supervisors, town boards of supervisors. They were patriot faction governments. In some places, they overlapped almost completely with the previous colonial establishment, but in other places they did not, and they were new, and they were used to bluntly to squelch political dissent. These committees would control the militia and then use the militia to enforce loyalty oaths and to suppress any gathering of Tories or even more than that. I mean, some people died.
One of the things you get the impression when you look at these local authorities that were set up, these provisional congresses, that it was the heart of, the root of, local control and the desire for continued local control that would evolve with the Republic.
You had a lot of local control in some of the colonies. One of the things I do, this book has many layers, but it starts early with an identification that says there were four vanguard colonies out of the 13, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Virginia and South Carolina. Now, these were, in some ways, the older ones. They were all 17th century in their origin. They had a long history of regarding themselves as almost little countries. They had foreign policies. They controlled militia. They fought wars against the French or against the Spanish or against the Indians. And they had, in each case, houses of the assemblies, the lower house of the legislatures, who were pretty much under their control. Sometimes they had a lot of trouble with the governors, but in the vanguard colonies, they had moved their local legislatures to the point where they were almost independent of British power, so they became a very effective vehicle in these colonies for self-government to begin almost immediately when the fighting started in 1775.
What was the concern in terms of the economic consequences of these ultimatums that had been given to Britain?
Well, I think that the people who ran the first Continental Congress had a somewhat naive view of the economy. They had the sense that the British would give in to these boycotts and to the threat that the exports of vital commodities, the whole raison d'etre of economic imperialism, that the British would accept this. Now, part of the reason they thought they would is that they had done smaller scale boycotts before, and they did have some role in forcing the British to back down on some policies. But what was done in 1774 went much, much further. It didn't use merchants to boycott the British. It just said these things will not be consumed, and it set up local committees, governments to handle it. And then it said, if the British don't do what we want, then we will cut off all these exports. Now, the British didn't accept this at all. They just, this is ridiculous. And they reacted as they're going out of the empire. They're violating law. This is treason, economic treason, but treason more broadly. So all this was set in motion way, way before the Declaration of Independence. And the British did not have the strength on the ground in the colonies to support themselves when the colonies moved in this kind of bold fashion, and they just lost control of everything.
What was done or considered during this period in 1775 in terms of military preparation by the colonists?
Well, in New England, they had put the militia in pretty good shape by the end of 1774, and militia in Rhode Island and New Hampshire seized gunpowder and cannon from the forts in the area of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then Newport, Rhode Island. The Virginia reorganized its militia, took it all very seriously. The committees of the assemblies in these colonies were very much involved. South Carolina's House of Assembly, which was its legislature, was so involved in military affairs that they had four separate committees that dealt with different parts of it. So they were very well equipped to just start mobilizing, to take control of powder magazines, to take cannon from forts. What they did need to do is they needed to get an enormous amount of additional cannon, additional gunpowder, and they started getting this overseas. And it was clear to British diplomats and military commanders by the end of the summer of 1774 that the colonists were procuring the means for revolution and sending ships basically around the world to get it. And again, one of these early signs, the British government put through an order in council in October 1774 banning the shipments of any unauthorized munitions to the North American colonies. So all of this was moving in a very, very major way. The notion that nothing was happening until the Declaration of Independence.
And it was a full year before, in the summer of 1775, that the Continental Congress declared its Declaration of Causes. Talk about that.
Well, what happened in June 1775, Congress voted to authorize a Continental Army, and Washington was named as its commander. In July 1775, Congress passed a declaration of causes and necessity for taking up arms. Now, you almost never read about this in the history book, but this was telling the British, look, hey, this is why we're doing it. Now, nominally, they professed continuing loyalty to King George, but King George scoffed at that, and within a week or two of receiving notice of the declaration of causes and necessity of taking up arms, then he declared the colonies in rebellion. So you had all of this moving very quickly to a military struggle, and you would think from the inattention to the declaration of the causes and necessity of taking up arms that it was some minor document, but it wasn't. They were taking up arms, and that document was part of what made the king issue his declaration that the colonies and colonists were in rebellion.
Talk about the political divisions, the political debates that took place within the Congress with respect to how best to proceed in these various areas.
Well, there's an enormous amount of difficulty that they had to deal with, and because they were very mindful that they could be thought of as committing treason, no records were kept. No annals of the proceedings were taken. So you have to piece it together, but basically what happened was that they had to resolve a number of difficulties quite quickly. The first was, well, I'm talking now about the Second Continental Congress that convened in May 1775. The first had come in September, October of 74, and it adjourned in October of 1774. The new Congress in 1775 had to grapple with everything. What would they do on the various trade boycotts, which were rapidly becoming outdated because the Battle of Bunker Hill was going to be fought in June, and that was an open confrontation. You knew that trade wasn't the issue anymore. It was forming an army, making the states, they weren't state, the colonies, the provinces work together, and somehow overcoming the fact that a large group of colonies wanted to go slow. The fire eaters were in New England and in the tobacco and plantation colonies, and that was the weight of the 13 colonies. But the middle colonies, which is to say New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, were much less sure they wanted to go that far. And their populations were much more divided, and getting them to support things that were two-fisted was quite difficult. The colonists invaded Canada in September of 1775, but one of the drawbacks was that the undecided colonies, the middle colonies, were pretty much opposed to it, and only reluctantly agreed, and New York, which was the staging area for the invasion of Canada, really did very little to support it because they hadn't organized much of a militia or military presence because they wanted to go slow.
One of the things you talk about is the tremendous impact of religion and ethnicity in some of these divisions. Talk about that.
Well, it's overwhelming. Churches were so important in that day and age, even though a lot of people didn't go to them, that it became a major way where people picked their associates and whose side they were going to be on. If you had churches, you had a lot of the different communities. But you had very sharp division between the churches, because the Congregational Church was the established church in New England, and that was pretty anti-English, frankly, and they were zealous in the Patriot side. The middle colonies had a whole lot of different churches, and that was part of the reason why they didn't agree. They had a much greater crazy quilt of religions and ethnic groups, including a lot of what they called peace Germans. These were the Amish, the Hutterites, the Mennonites, who had flown from wars in Europe. And then the southern colonies, the plantation colonies, they had what I call, low church Anglicans is probably the best way to say, Episcopalians. This was the Church of England, but these colonies have been separate and laws unto themselves for long enough that they had control of the local Anglican churches, and it was sort of like a country club for the tobacco planters, to be blunt. And as a result, the Anglicans there, who were low church and anti-British, were very different from the small group of Anglicans in the northern colonies who were very pro-British and very high church. And the German churches were divided. But if you know the churches and the denominations in an area, it goes a long way towards telling you how they would cleave or adhere to each other. Generally speaking, it was the combination of ethnicity and religion was the greatest denominator of who was on what side.
How did so much of this history get lost, essentially, in ways that created this mythology around 1776?
Well, it's hard for me to say because I've always been so fascinated by this in an earlier incarnation, mostly because I was involved in all kinds of politics of knowing who voted why and for what reason and in what county or in what state. Somehow, because the idea was that in 1776, everybody came together and agreed, and we had the Declaration of Independence, and it was this great document, most of which was ignored, that you don't want to talk about all the different building blocks of disagreement. But the building blocks of disagreement were huge. And it took 2 years of serious politics to get to the point where, with the British about to invade, you had to pass a Declaration of Independence to be able to be a separate power to deal with the French and the Dutch and the Spanish. And that was the big need for it. The whole idea of the spirit of 1776 and the Declaration of Independence is sort of togetherness, and it wasn't. That wasn't how the country took shape. I mean, there was a lot of togetherness in places, but in the larger scheme of things, there were enormous disagreements too.
And yet, it is those building blocks, the things that you talk about in 1774 and primarily 1775, that in many ways reflect issues that are still part of the American experience.
Well, it's clear that anybody who thinks that the American political process doesn't reflect a whole lot of things that are similar to what we had back then. Obviously, religion, ethnicity, culture, race, economics, the economics of selfishness often, because people watch out for themselves. There was some political ideology, but it usually was partly religious or partly economic. There were all kinds of heartfelt senses that it was time for the colonies to control their own fate. The regulation imposed by the British was getting harder and harder to justify as the size and importance and sophistication of the colonies ballooned. The growth of population was just staggering. You went from, about a million in 1750 to just something under 2.7, 2.8 million in 1775. The buildup, the wealth and everything, it just outgrew British regulations. So that was another part of it. The bridling against the commercial regulation of the British, not all of it ill-intentioned. Some of it was, but not all of it. It was just that the colonies had gotten too big, and so many people in Europe were talking about that. A lot of the European countries figured this is our chance to really stick it to the British, because if these colonies revolt, the British Empire is going to lose its main source of strength.
Kevin Phillips. The book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. It's just out from Viking. Kevin, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.